Clearly, South Korea is sending a message to the world that South Korea is not shy about making investments, major investments in North Korea.
Korean leaders meet to forge common ground. It's Wednesday, September 19th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, new tariffs fuel new trade concerns. A criminal investigation opens on Rohingya atrocities. Australia inspects his food. World fashion in New York. And ancient bread making. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The third inter-Korean summit is underway in Pyongyang with a joint statement expected Wednesday. It is the first visit to the North Korean capital by a South Korean leader in 11 years. Sungyoon Lee, associate professor in Korean studies at Tufts University in Massachusetts, tells VOA's Victor Beatty while South Korean President Moon Jae-in hopes to achieve progress on a peace treaty and obtain an inventory of the North's nuclear arsenal, the meeting with Kim Jong-un mostly benefits the North.
Because North Korea will be able to further advance its image as a normal country, a normal global statesman presiding over a not-so-abnormal dictatorship, and North Korea will further gain the momentum of engaging the United States and further trapping the Trump administration into mind-boggling, never-ending negotiation process without reaching a resolution. What's in it for the South Korean visitor, President Moon? Well, if you declare an end of the Korean War between North Korea and South Korea, that sounds like genuine peace is near. But when you're talking about peace, what are we really talking about? How many wars have there been in the Korean Peninsula since the end of the Korean War in 1953? Zero. A shaky peace it's been, but there has been no war. There has been de facto peace. So why is there such an insistence on the part of South Korea to declare the end of the war and conclude a peace treaty and so on? Because that would further advance South Korea's interest in re-engaging North Korea financially, that is, subsidizing the Kim regime under the illusion of peace and reconciliation. And this is all good politics. So we see a convergence of interests between the two Korean states, and I think the Trump administration will find itself in a tight position. It will be very difficult for Trump to declare, to admit that he was duped by the North Korean dictator in Singapore. Rather, to the contrary, Trump will want to have a follow-up summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, and all this favors Kim Jong-un.
What is the best that we can hope for out of this summit?
Well, clearly South Korea is sending a message to the world that South Korea is not shy about making investments, major investments in North Korea, returning to the same kind of unconditional subsidization of the Kim regime as we saw under President Roh Moo-hyun, President Moon's former boss, who was the president between 2003 and 2008. When the South Korean government gave North Korea, no questions asked, an average of $900 million a year for 5 years, most of it in cash. So I think sanctions enforcement is that in name only. There is no real political will to enforce sanctions, certainly not on the part of China or Russia or South Korea. And sending this kind of message that engaging North Korea and giving generously to North Korea will guarantee peace, eliminate the possibility, the danger of war, and so forth. Again, it's good business. It's very short-sighted, that kind of thinking on the part of Seoul, South Korea. But in the short term, there are pragmatic benefits, political benefits to this kind of unconventional approach to engaging North Korea.
Sungyoon Lee said President Donald Trump's impulsive summit with the North Korean leader in Singapore in June set the stage for the kind of sanctions busting the U.S. has decried at the United Nations. Monday in the Security Council, the U.S. accused Russia of consistent and wide-ranging violations of international sanctions over the North's nuclear and missile programs. Russia and China have called for an easing of sanctions, given the North's pledge to denuclearize. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. North and South Korean leaders hold third summit. China retaliates for $200 billion in U.S. tariffs. The United Nations says Myanmar military command must be investigated for genocide. Typhoon Manghat leaves lasting damage in China and the Philippines. Tesla's Musk sued for calling Thai cave rescuer a pedophile. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China says it has no choice but to retaliate to U.S. President Donald Trump's 10% tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese goods, risking a further escalation of trade tensions between the world's two biggest economies. On Tuesday, China announced a tariff hike on $60 billion of American products. Last week, the United States extended an invitation to China's top negotiator, Liu He, to resume talks later this month in Washington. The $200 billion in U.S. tariffs goes into effect in less than a week, September the 24th, leaving the two sides little time to sit down. On Monday, President Trump warned in a statement announcing his move, if China retaliates against U.S. farmers or other industries, Washington will immediately pursue Phase 3, which is tariffs on approximately $267 billion in additional imports. The additional $267 billion in tariffs is expected to cover all Chinese imports to the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Alan Sykes, professor of law at the Stanford University Law School and a leading expert on international economics relations, if the latest moves mean that a full-fledged trade war between the U.S. and China is now in effect.
Well, I don't know that there's any formal definition of full-fledged trade war, but it certainly seems like a trade war to me. It's been cycling up from relatively low-scale activity on washing machines and solar panels to steel and aluminum, and now tens of billions of dollars in all sorts of products.
What is going to happen now that China has not backed down? President Trump has threatened there is another phase where just about everything that China, anything that can be subject to a tariff will be done. Do you see this as moving in that direction? And what about the scheduled meetings for early next week?
Well, it's certainly a sort of kind of a brinksmanship situation here. The president imposed these tariffs the last day or so and announced at the same time that he would impose many more if China retaliated, and China has retaliated. So now I suppose the ball is in President Trump's court to decide whether to follow through on his threat of additional Chinese tariffs. I think that there's a strong amount of pressure on both countries to bring this to an amicable conclusion. It's not going to help either economy. China is relatively weaker than we are right now, but it will begin to take its toll on the United States, one suspects, fairly soon. So, you know, meetings next week are a good sign. Whether there will be an atmosphere where something can actually get accomplished, I don't know. I don't have any prediction for how this will turn out.
Is there any light at the end of the tunnel for such a meeting?
Well, certainly China could make some concessions on things. The president has never been terribly specific about exactly what he wants China to do, which is it's harmful in one sense because it's not clear what he would accept as a satisfactory resolution. On the other hand, it gives enormous flexibility to both sides to settle on relatively modest concessions and declare victory.
Where do you stand on tariffs?
Well, I think certainly tariffs over the long term are harmful to the world economy. They reduce productive efficiency. They reduce global income. An ideal world would be a world without tariffs. But at the same time, one can make an argument that if you could negotiate a better outcome through the use of temporary tariffs to gain negotiating leverage. And if you could use tariffs to get better protection for U.S. intellectual property, for example, it's conceivable that the tariff policy might actually work out to the benefit of the United States in the long run. But that's it all depends on how the negotiation plays out. And my crystal ball is in the shop. I just don't know what's going to happen.
How much is this hurting, and how much could it hurt U.S. consumers, U.S. farmers, anyone else who might be affected by these tariffs?
I can't give you quantitative figures in response to your question, but certainly as the scope of the tariffs broadens, more and more U.S. buyers of Chinese goods are going to be affected. And as the tariff rates rise from the initial 10% to 25% and so forth, the pain will increase as well. Certainly we're having this latest round involves more consumer products, more important industrial products. And China has threatened to potentially try and cut off some exports of things to the United States that are really an essential part of our supply chain. So it's just it's possible that it could become quite painful.
Alan Sykes, professor of law at the Stanford University Law School, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Happening now in Asia, the Asian Development Bank is expanding in the Pacific Islands, opening 7 new country offices and expecting its loans and grants to top $4 billion by 2020. The pledge from the Japan-led bank comes amidst a vigorous new campaign by the United States and allies to check China's rising sway in the region. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. The chief prosecutor of The Hague's International Criminal Court, or ICC, announced Tuesday she would launch an investigation into the allegedly forced deportation of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims from Bangladesh to Myanmar. Fatou Bensouda said the preliminary examination may take into account a number of alleged coercive acts that have resulted in the forced displacement of the Rohingya people, including deprivation of fundamental rights, killing, sexual violence, enforced disappearance, destruction and looting, and that the ICC has authority to look into the matter.
Since late 2017, my office has received communications and reports on crimes allegedly committed against the Rohingya people in Myanmar and their deportation to Bangladesh. My office reviewed these communications under the first phase of our preliminary examination activities. Our review highlighted a preliminary legal issue concerning the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, which I brought to the attention of the court's judges. The judges of the pretrial chamber 1 have confirmed that this court may indeed exercise jurisdiction over the alleged deportation of the Rohingya people from Myanmar to Bangladesh.
Myanmar's Buddhist military has been accused of waging a genocidal campaign against the country's Rohingya minority, burning villages and committing acts of rape, torture, and murder. Some 700,000 Rohingya are estimated to have fled to neighboring Bangladesh since August last year. Although Myanmar is not a member of the ICC, Chief Prosecutor Bensouda said the court has jurisdiction because the alleged crimes involve Bangladesh, which is a member.
While Myanmar is not a state party to the ICC, Bangladesh is. The ICC may exercise jurisdiction over conduct to the extent it partly occurred on the territory of Bangladesh. In this context, the preliminary examination may take into account a number of alleged coercive acts having resulted in the forced displacement of the Rohingya people. This includes deprivation of fundamental rights, killing, sexual violence, enforced disappearance, destruction, and looting.
The ICC is an international court that only steps in when national authorities are unwilling to prosecute alleged crimes. Coming up, sharp fears in food. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more.
broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America. This news from VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump has accused China of actively trying to impact and change the U.S. election. Trump said China has openly stated that they are actively trying to impact and change the election by attacking farmers, ranchers, and industrial workers because of their loyalty to him. You'll make a positive impact each time you visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a food safety scare hits Australia, while impending tariffs may stunt the growth of farmers' profits. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
A food scare in Australia has halted strawberry exports to New Zealand and forced at least one farm to start dumping its fruit at the peak of the season. Authorities say there have been multiple reports of needles embedded into strawberries. Danny Doherty is a superintendent at the New South Wales Police Department.
It's not just strawberries that now we are receiving reports for. We've also had some isolated reports of contamination of banana and apple in the Sydney area.
The needles were originally found in strawberries produced from one supplier in the northern state of Queensland, but are now turning up around the country. The country's largest strawberry-producing region, Queensland, has set aside $1 million to help farmers survive the season, while the state government is offering a $71,950 reward for information leading to any arrests. In the meantime, fear is making people cautious. Carmela DiCarlo is a resident in Sydney.
That just freaked me out because I'm thinking, my daughter normally just grabs and just bites into apples.
Farmers are doing what they can to protect their produce, some even scanning their fruit with metal detectors before shipping them out. Farmers in California's Central Valley are bracing for the impact of China's increased tariffs on agricultural produce. China declared plans to levy additional duties on up to $3 billion of U.S. imports in retaliation against U.S. President Donald Trump's plans to slap tariffs on up to $60 billion in Chinese goods. Almond grower Jake Wenger is among many farmers concerned that their product will be at a competitive disadvantage on the global market.
We as a nation shouldn't be in the business of making it difficult to get our goods and services and products into foreign markets. Our job is to encourage foreign markets to buy American products.
Wenger and his family have been farming in the Central Valley for four generations. They grow around 700 acres of walnuts and almonds and sell most of their almond crop to Blue Diamond, a grower cooperative that exports to China. According to Richard Wacott, the president of the Almond Board of California, almonds are California's second largest acreage crop and the state's most valuable agricultural export.
Our industry, to a certain extent, you know, lives and dies by the export markets because they're such an important part of our business.
China's top economic official, Vice Premier Li Hu, is scheduled to visit Washington next week for talks with U.S. Secretary for the Treasury Steve Mnuchin. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, Elon Musk, the chief executive of Tesla, is being sued for defamation for falsely suggesting that a British caver who helped save 12 boys and their soccer coach from a Thailand cave in July was a pedophile and a child rapist. Tesla did not immediately respond to requests for comment. You may always comment on stories we post on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, New York is one of the world's fashion capitals, and it goes all out for 8 days every September with an extravaganza of runway shows known as Fashion Week. For designers, it is a prime opportunity to exhibit their creations. And as Laura Spolveda reports for the city, it's a major source of revenue.
Once a year, Fashion Week provides designers a global stage on which to showcase their work and hopefully attract prestigious buyers. hundreds of them, converge in New York City. It's a show of colors, textures, and catwalks, where designers seek to conquer the world fashion market.
It's an industry that impacts the local economy a lot because it brings in around $900 million a year.
And the event not only benefits people involved in the industry, much of the money finds its way into all parts of the local economy.
From models, restaurants, designers, manufacturers, even the real estate market benefits from everything that has to do with the fashion industry here in New York.
Being part of this event requires a big network and a big budget.
If designers want to come and show their creations here at New York Fashion Week, they should be ready to spend at least $200,000.
And this is only the beginning, says Sylvania, because the cost of renting a stand and hiring staff, models, makeup artists, and so forth is not predetermined and could easily rise if the year's show is especially popular. Some experts believe this year's Fashion Week could generate more money for the city than sporting events like the U.S. Open, the New York City Marathon, and the 2014 Super Bowl. Laura Sepúlveda, VOA News, New York.
A new bakery that opened here in Washington, D.C. last year has a unique approach to baking, using whole grains grown locally and milled on site. As VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us in this narration by Faith Lapidus, Selu is the culmination of a journey for a young man who started out as a musician and became a baker.
The newest addition to the bread baking scene in Washington, D.C. is Selu. The word means majestic bird in the West African language Mandinka. Selu was inspired by a trip to Senegal by bakery co-author Jonathan Bethany more than 15 years ago. The music student went to learn West African drumming, but became more interested in working with local farmers. He wanted to help villagers who were struggling for their next meal. When he came back to the U.S., he started working in restaurants and discovered a passion for baking. His main ingredients, the grains, are freshly harvested from local farms.
We use about 20 different varieties of grains, and that's all organic.
Bethany grinds all of his wheat on site, the only bakery in Washington that does that.
I really like the freshness that milling your own grains brings to the aroma and the flavor of the bread.
Bethany's unique approach to bread making caught the attention of Sam Fromarts, author of a book aptly titled In Search of the Perfect Loaf. He says knowing how to mill and knowing which grains to use is what gives each type of bread its unique texture and taste.
One type of flour from a particular grain might ferment really quickly. Another may take much longer, you know. One might be really appropriate for, say, a baguette like this, and another type of flour might not be appropriate for that.
Selu is one of just a few bakeries in the nation that sells 100% whole wheat sourdough bread. And its pastry products are also made from whole grains and contain no refined white sugar. Bethany is able to do that by surrounding himself with like-minded people, a pastry chef willing to experiment with non-traditional ingredients, and a supportive wife, a teacher and yoga instructor who became his business partner.
It's a very rewarding opportunity for me to get to meet all kinds of great people walking in through the door and working with our staff and working with the farmers that we work with on a regular basis.
Bethany forms each loaf by hand, feeding them one by one into a wood-fired oven. Each loaf takes about 36 hours from start to finish, a long, involved process that requires commitment and heart. But his customers say the results are worth waiting for. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Perhaps you're one of the many who tuned in to Chiang Mai University Radio, FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. We thank everyone there who listened to our program today. You can also follow us online. We stream every day at VOA Asia Facebook and at our website, voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Rob McClain, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.